Vermont Viewpoint is a public affairs program produced and funded by WDEV and the Radio Vermont Group. We welcome listener feedback. Email your comments to vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com.
Good morning. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. I'm Rick Singeri. The majestic, graceful dragon boats will be back on Lake Champlain this Sunday, so we'll start the show there. Next, we'll learn about some big news from CV Fiber and meet its new executive director. At 10, national correspondent Bob Ney slides over to Thursday this week, and then we'll take a stroll through the Von Trapp Gardens in Waitsfield, and we'll finish the morning maybe looking for a guest or two. If you'd like to be interviewed at 10:30, you can shoot an email to vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Maybe a little info about you, and then we'll see what happens. But first, Sunday is the day for Dragon Boat athletes and fans. And here to tell us all about it is Dragonheart Vermont Executive Director Nina Atkinson. Nina, thanks for being on Vermont Viewpoint again and so close to the big event.
Yes, good morning, Rick. How are you?
I'm great. How you doing?
Oh, very excited for Sunday. We can't wait to see everybody out at the Burlington Waterfront to watch our races and to see our community paddle for charity.
Yeah, it really gets exciting. And Sunday, we're going to give you all the details. Listeners, if you'd like to ask Nina about the Dragon Boats, or if you'd like to let us know if you've ever competed, you can call us at 802-244-1777, 877-291-8255, or email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. All right, let's get the details when, where things are happening Sunday at the Lake Champlain Dragon Boat Festival.
Well, our first race kicks off with breast cancer survivor teams at 8:30, and every race is a 200-meter race, which means our paddlers will paddle for just about under a minute as hard and as fast as they can right down the waterfront shoreline at the Burlington Waterfront. It's really fun and exciting to see. We have a whole park load full of fun things to do while you're there, just in case you don't want to watch every race. But we have over 600 community paddlers helping us out, helping us raise money for cancer survivors here in Vermont.
8:30, that's got to be a rather invigorating way, Nina, and to hear the drum beat going and really straining your muscles to move those dragon boats. Great way, I guess, to start a day, isn't it?
It is. Now, these races will take off probably every 3 minutes, so throughout the day on Sunday, you can come down and see all the excitement.
I love it. For anyone who's never seen them, what are the Dragon Boats?
Dragon Boats, Dragon Boat Racing is about 3,000 years old. It's a Chinese sport. It's been adopted by the rest of the world because it is such a great team activity that really tests your body, mind, and spirit. The breast cancer survivors have taken on this sport because it actually helps in our convalescence. It helps us become stronger. It helps us come out of our surgery much better and fitter. And there's great camaraderie around the world with dragon boat teams that are just breast cancer survivors.
And let's talk about go ahead, Nina.
Yeah, the boats are about 40 feet long. Paddlers sit side by side facing forward. And the trick to a fast boat is to paddle in sync.
It absolutely is. If you can just tell, you're watching a boat kind of drift behind another one, and you could tell that you're watching the paddles hit the water at different times, right? And the other one, and the one that's moving ahead, they're all hitting the water and stroking at the exact same time. It just flies.
Exactly. It's like comparing a graceful, synchronized swimming team with Barney and Fred from the Flintstones in their
Yeah. Yeah. And, you'll know when you're in a Barney and Fred boat, you just get pretty frustrated. Now, this is put on by Dragonheart Vermont. So, why was that formed? What is the mission of the group?
Dragonheart Vermont has been around since 2004. We're a nonprofit organization that supports breast cancer survivors and their families and supporters in the state of Vermont. And we take care of our community by giving back. Our biggest charity fundraiser is this coming Sunday, the Lake Champlain Dragon Boat Festival, where we're raising funds that will help the Cancer Patient Support Foundation, which is another great cancer support organization.
And so didn't Dragonheart start, and you all had some dragon boats you competed in, and then started the festival? Is that how it kind of went?
Yes. We started in 2004 with John and Linda Dyer, our founders, who are still very active today in our organization. We started because Linda is a breast cancer survivor and heard about the great healing that dragon boating does for breast cancer survivors. So they actually borrowed a dragon boat and down at the waterfront grabbed people walking on the bike path to help paddle and spread the word and get people interested in dragon boat paddling. A couple of years later, they started the festival, which again raises funds for local breast cancer and cancer wellness organizations.
Yeah, the festival being the opportunity for community members to climb in these beautiful boats and help raise money and take part in something that is unique. There's nothing else you can participate in that's quite like this, is there, Nina?
There isn't. It is the funnest fundraiser of the summer, for sure.
And the most strenuous. And as you mentioned, it really takes syncopated skill. So you have I'll let you explain this better, but there's a drummer that you stroke with, you follow, and people in the boat watch a paddler up front and try to mimic exactly their motions in time. Am I getting that right?
Exactly. So our 20 paddlers who are in 10 rows, 2x2, are facing forward with the steersman who's steering in the back. And the drummer is the only competitor who is facing backwards.
Right.
They are facing the team and they are shouting commands as well as giving encouragement and actually setting the pace. So we as paddlers will listen to what the drummer has to say in full faith that we are going to get to our destination the best way that we possibly can.
Yeah. Now, have the participants for Sunday's festival had the opportunity to get trained and practice in the dragon boats?
Yes, we've had teams register and sign up for a practice session, which was 2 weeks ago, our practice weekend. If anybody was down at the waterfront in early July, they saw our boats going out regularly and lots of people coming off a little wet with lots of smiles, but it gives everybody an opportunity to learn the basic strokes, the basic commands, get a feel for what it's like to be in a 40-foot long, very skinny boat. We are still accepting registrations for what we call free agents.
Mm-hmm.
And this is for finding folks who do want to paddle on Sunday, but are not associated with a team. And our existing teams may have a couple of openings here and there. And we would take our free agents who are signing up now and filling up and the teams that are already existing. It's a great opportunity to meet some people, get out on the water, exert your energy for about a minute, and come off the water feeling good.
So if someone's an interested free agent, they haven't signed with any other teams, how do they take part in this Sunday's festival, and what will it cost? How do they get involved?
We do have a link on our homepage. Our website is www. www.dragonheartvermont.org. There is a link to register. The registration fee is $50 with a small fundraising commitment associated with that. And it's a heck of a lot of fun.
Oh, my gosh. Is it ever? Because there's a lot more that goes on than just taking part. And we'll get to that after the break. But, you know, being in the dragon boat and rowing is just part of what you'll experience, both rowers and spectators this Sunday down on the lakefront. All right. Nina, right before the break, we talked about it being a really big day. It's a festival. So what happens at the Dragon Boat Festival?
Well, of course, we've got the races that go off every 3 minutes or so. But the highlight of the day is what you mentioned earlier, the Breast Cancer Survivor Flower Ceremony. That takes place right before noon. It is something that is so memorable and so touching. It is an on-water event for the breast cancer survivor teams that get in their boats and tether together. Everybody holds on to a sunflower around the docks and the shoreline. Everyone who has been touched by cancer can also get a hold of a sunflower. We do a little bit of a song as well as a dedication to our survivors and our loved ones. And then we toss our flowers in Lake Champlain. It's incredibly moving, and it's a very beautiful ceremony.
What's the significance of the sunflower?
Our sunflowers are donated by one of our members who is also a breast cancer survivor, and they just represent the joy that we hold at Dragon Heart Vermont.
Mm. That happens at noon, you said?
Just before noon, around 11:45. So it's again, the festival is a free event to come and capture the energy and the essence of Dragon Heart Vermont. Our mission to support breast cancer survivors, all cancer survivors, down at the waterfront. It's really just a fun day at any time you come down.
And when do the races get started? How early can people get down there and start seeing the color, the pageantry, the fun?
Well, we will start off with breast cancer survivor teams racing at 8:30, and races will take off every 3 minutes after that throughout the day. The short pause is for the breast cancer ceremony, and then a fun race happens immediately after that, celebrating the top three fundraising teams in what we call the Splash for Cash Dash.
This is brand new, isn't it?
Yes, it is. We thought we should give some big kudos and bragging rights to the teams that raise money for our cancer support organizations here in Vermont.
All right. And is this a competition, aside from the Splash for Cash Dash, which are the top fundraising teams, but during the course of the day, are teams kind of moving to a final to kind of win the festival?
There is a Champ Cup. The Trophy Cup is presented by our presenting sponsor, Community Bank. So the Community Bank Championship Cup will be given to the fastest team at the end of the day.
Oh, that's fantastic. I did the math, but I'm going to ask anyway, how many teams are competing? You said there were 600 paddlers, so I think I know about how many teams you have right now, but how many are competing?
We have 44 teams. There are some teams in our sport division which will have 22 paddlers. Our breast cancer teams that are coming from out of state and participating in this celebratory weekend of breast cancer survivors are also 22 paddlers. The community teams, for partly COVID, are 17 paddlers or 17 competitors in the boat.
Okay, gotcha. 44 teams. That's great. But there's still room in some boats, and that is this new opportunity to be a free agent. In the past, you had to have a full team, but now you've kind of extended it. If someone, an individual or a few individuals, don't have a full team, how do they get to play? How do they get to jump into a dragon boat on Sunday?
Exactly. They can come to our website, and on our homepage, there's a link to sign up as an individual paddler. We will then immediately contact you to let you know which team we've assigned you to. And then we'll take care of you on festival day, introducing you to the team, giving you a couple of pointers before you get out on the boat so that you can have a whole lot of fun for the 1 minute of racing.
How many people went the free agent route this year? Do you know?
I don't have a count, but it was very well received. We decided to make this an official entry category because we've always had folks come up saying, you know, I'm not part of a team. I've always wanted to. If you hear of anything opening up, let me contact that team, or can I contact that team? Now we're making it very easy for folks who are interested in giving dragon boating a try, helping our cancer organizations in Vermont by opening up this free agent program. And it's been quite well received. We're really happy to be able to help people who've always wanted to paddle but have never had the right opportunity because they didn't have a team to put in.
Yeah, brilliant idea. There's no team made completely of free agents, right? They're just filling in spots on other teams?
Yep, there's no team that is called a free agent team. That would be a really fun team, though, I bet.
I know. Here we are. We are the misfits. And it would be fun. At some point, that might happen. Let's talk about, for those not competing, the spectators, what will they experience at the festival?
Well, there are a full complement of exhibitors and tents down at the Burlington Waterfront. It is free to anybody. We do have evening entertainment on Saturday night, co-hosted by Foam Brewers, and the band is the Medallions. There is a door charge of $10, but the band will play from 7 to 9:30. They are a disco funk, great to dance to band, and that will kick off our weekend on Saturday night in time for fun and energy on Sunday. Again, there's the flower ceremony midday on Sunday, the fun celebratory splash for cash dash immediately afterwards. There are award presentations for the fastest teams towards mid-afternoon. But you will also be able to visit the tents on site. There's Ben and Jerry's ice cream. There's great food trucks that are also coming. And you'll be able to meet other folks who have a strong connection with our cancer community.
And this is the biggest fundraiser of the year for Dragon Heart Vermont, as you mentioned. Where does the money go that's raised?
Every year, we choose a pledge recipient, a shared pledge recipient, and this year we are sharing the proceeds with the Cancer Patient Support Foundation, which is a great organization that helps Vermonters in need during this terrible disruption of our lives when diagnosed with cancer.
Yeah. Now, one, we've talked about the color and the beauty, the majestic boats, the dragon boats. But when you're on shore, there's a lot going on. People are dressed up, right? There's colorful people, and there's chants, going on. Give a sense of that spirit that really, kind of encompasses, the whole festival.
I'm glad you mentioned that because there is this spirit component to the festival that really keeps smiles on faces all day long. We have a crew of spirit judges who will go through the community team's athlete village site and check out how the teams have decorated their tent site, if they have a chant or a dance or costumes that are deserving of the Spirit Awards. our folks will go through, and they are dressed incredibly fun to give out prizes. And if you go on our website and you check out some of the team names, you can tell that our community teams really get into the spirit, and we will see some beautiful, colorful, and very unique costumes there at the waterfront. It's quite fun.
It is fun. Teams are encouraged to pick those fun, spicy, interesting names. You said there's the chanting, the dancing. So teams get together, go Saturday night to Foam Brewery to see the medallions, get a little groove together so you can show off on Sunday. Now, Nina, this is the big question. What kind of weather have you ordered for Sunday for the Lake Champlain Dragon Boat Festival?
Well, we've put in our orders with all the local meteorologists, and we're hoping for good weather. We're preparing for some not-so-good weather as well, but we will be ready to react to any strange occurrences that might be coming from the sky. We are also prepared to be a very safe COVID prevention environment. We'll be offering masks for anybody who wants some. We'll have sanitation stations all throughout Waterfront Park. Our volunteers will be masked as well. And of course, we're outdoors, but still following great distancing protocols as well.
Absolutely. Nina Atkinson is the Dragonheart Vermont Executive Director. To learn more about the Lake Champlain Dragon Boat Festival and Dragonheart Vermont, you can visit dragonheartvermont.org. Nina, here's wishing you calm winds and waves on Sunday. Thanks for being on the show again.
Thank you so much, everybody. Good to talk to you, Rick.
All right, great talking to you. We're going to take a break for a CBS News update, and then we'll meet the new executive director of CV Fiber. And the Red Sox move on to Kansas City to enjoy some great barbecue and to take on the Royals. Coverage begins tonight at 7:10, first pitch at 8:10. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Did you know that Radio Vermont Group Digital Services can create videos including drone footage? We've even won awards for our videos. If you'd like to learn more and see examples of our work, go to rvgdigital.com. Radio Vermont Group, we're more than just radio.
We're back on Vermont Viewpoint. The need for high-speed internet has been known and has been great in Vermont for quite some time. The pandemic exacerbated the need by the power of three or four. And we're not going to spend time going down that road. Rather, it's time to hear how we're making strides now to meet that need. Joining me to discuss it is Janelle Smith, who became the executive director of CV Fiber earlier this year. Janelle, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Good morning, Rick, and hello to all your listeners. Thanks so much for having me today.
Good morning, and they all say hello back. Listeners, if you'd like to ask Janelle about what's happening at CV Fiber and her vision for the future, you can give us a call at 802-244-1777 or 877-291-8255 or email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Janelle, what is CV Fiber?
CV Fiber is one of nine communications union districts within the state of Vermont. That is a group of towns that have decided to band together to work toward building high-speed internet in their communities. CV Fiber serves primarily central Vermont. That's where the CV originally came from.
And for those who aren't quite sure, what is a communications union district, or CUD?
It's a group of towns that have decided to band together to work toward bringing high-speed internet to the previously underserved or unserved members of their communities. That is folks who have a slow internet speed or perhaps no internet at all. And so they've decided to come together. There's power in numbers, and these communities are building a large number of miles of backbone for available internet. So CV Fiber has 21 member districts within central Vermont.
And is a CUD, is it a government entity? Is it a nonprofit? Is it an apps? Is it a business? What exactly is it structurally?
Yes, yes, and yes.
Wow, I hit on all three.
Yes, it is a public nonprofit utility, municipal utility district. It is also a company. It's run as a company, but for the people, to bring public service of high-speed internet to the people. So it is a nonprofit, it is a company, and it is a municipal organization. It was established under the Vermont Legislature Act 71, and it is overseen by the Vermont Communications Broadband Board. So that's a state entity.
All right. I'm going to get personal for just a few minutes now. What does it mean to you to be the first executive director of CV Fiber?
We're doing big things. This is the first time we've ever brought high-speed internet to rural Vermont. And I grew up here. I grew up in Vermont and in the 80s, and high-speed internet was not an option. Now that it is an option and we understand how important it is to learning, to healthcare, to communications with businesses and to communications with your loved ones, it means a lot to me to be bringing the first in class high speed internet where we previously have not been able to bring it before due to certain constraints in finances or in terrain. And now with the ARPA funding, that is the federal COVID funds, we're able to start to launch this vision. So to get personal, it means to me connecting the people I love to the whole world, to each other, in the rural parts of Vermont. So you don't need to be face-to-face to get the connections with businesses and people that we realized were so necessary during the pandemic.
Janelle, what are the goals that you set for CV Fiber this year and then for the next 3 or 4 years?
Yeah, so it takes time to build out a network. It's construction, and there are certain constraints that you run into, that we're running into with materials availability and such. The goals are to build out 1,200 miles of fiber over the next 3 to 4 years in central Vermont. And this does start with about 400 miles through the end of 2023. We're already starting on the make-ready work and getting ready the poles with the utility companies that we'll be attaching to. We're building as early as the end of this year for certain parts of the backbone or distribution areas.
You've been on the job for 4 months. First of all, how have you settled in and what have you been able to accomplish so far?
Well, we've accomplished a lot, and it's fun work. A lot of what we've done is we've secured warehousing for our equipment. We've received some of the equipment that had long lead times, and we have been working with folks who are specializing in the design of the network, who will be operating the network, and who are working with us toward pole applications and easements and permits for the entire project.
Have there been any surprises that have cropped up in those 4 months that have made the job, let's say, challenging?
Sure. They say that the only constant is change, and and every plan has unpredictable, I call them sleeping dragons. So yes, there are certainly surprises. Limitations on warehousing was one such surprise, but we were very fortunate. We were able to locate some great spaces to store our equipment. We also have, like every industry, run into certain supply chain shortages, and we know to order in advance. So we've been doing that. So yes, absolutely surprises. And the fun part about surprises is how to how to meet them as they come.
Yeah. In one of my earliest jobs, my predecessor called it a box of snakes. And so she said, you'll never know when you're going to open up a box of snakes. And, you know, it could be tomorrow or it could be 6 months into the job, but they will be there for you. So, yeah, it's how we handle them with grace and dignity and with answers. Talk about the technology and the service that CV Fiber will be providing to its customers.
Yeah, so for any folks out there who are listening who may not have high-speed internet yet or understand its benefits, high-speed internet is it is the ability to connect with other people, businesses, information very quickly at the speed of light. Essentially, fiber optics is literally glass and moves at the speed of light. So folks can connect with one another real time. So the services that the high-speed internet service will allow people to see their doctors. It'll allow folks to work from home. Even high-tech industries that require fast internet service. For instance, there are solutions in farming that will allow farms to become much more efficient and produce greater crop yields through applications that they can use on devices that require high-speed internet. We've talked a lot about, in the industry, the digital divide and how people in cities have more access to high-speed internet and connectivity and the new technology and applications than folks that may live in a more rural area. And part of that is simply the cost of hooking up the rural communities. However, rural communities need high-speed internet as much as urban communities. And we now know that people are living and working from home. So the idea and the ideal is to be able to connect everyone, including at the last mile in the most rural parts of the country, including Vermont, so that we can bridge that digital divide, that gap.
That's the technology side, Janiel. Let's look at the mechanical, the actual physical side. You had mentioned having to install 1,200 miles of fiber. That sounds like quite a bit. But what actually has to be done physically? And how long does it take? Like you mentioned, you'll hope to have 400 miles by the end of next year. So kind of give us a picture of what it does take to connect these homes who are waiting for high-speed internet.
Sure. When I explain it to the kids, I explain it as, hey, we're just putting toothpicks in clay. You know, you can picture it like that. But really what we're doing is we're working with utility companies who have already placed toothpicks in clay. So there's a line of communication wires outside your door going along the road, and that's what powers your electricity, that's what powers your telephone. And that will be what powers your fiber as well. So we will physically take giant spools of wire. So they're physically giant spools of wire that go on the communication space of the existing telephone poles that are running along your road. So that will include and require some getting ready the pole. So make sure that the pole is in good shape to support that additional wire. Some of it is tree trimming around the pole and in the stands between the poles so that you can physically actually hang that wire. So that's what it actually entails if you're looking at it from a perspective of putting toothpicks in clay to physically build the network.
And I've seen a picture of Janiel in front of one of those spools of wire. The spools of wire are about twice the height of Janiel Smith, who I'm speaking with of CV Fiber about some of the developments at this Communications Union District. Janiel, CV Fiber recently received some very good news. Tell us about the grant that you were approved for.
Yes, CV Fiber has received about 40% of its needs to build the network in ARPA funding or federal grant funding, and this is what allows us to form the public-private partnerships and start the launch of the of the network. We're extremely grateful to the VCBB for these funds. And I also wanted to say that although the funds are going to help us launch the network, we're still more than half of our funding away from needing from what we need to actually build the network. It will cost more to build the network, so we're seeking additional funding. But yes, we are extremely grateful for the funding that allows us to get off the ground running.
$12.6 million to get you started. But where will you then, you know, come up with the other 60% of funding?
So we are looking into most likely we'll need to go to the bond market, the municipal bond market, by the middle of next year. However, we are looking into additional funding. And also the towns within our member districts have been generous in committing funds, and some of them have committed some of their own ARPA funds toward building out in their communities. So that has helped to fill the gaps a bit. Some towns have not committed, but certainly can still. And the Vermont Communications Broadband Board is matching dollar for dollar until September 15th, any donations that are made from our member communities from their own ARPA funds. Mm. So it's really a grassroots effort, and money is coming from a lot of different places. And thank God for that, because yeah, this is what is allowing us to start the launch of the network.
Janiel, the good news is you have 21 communities that are connected to CV Fiber. The bad news is you have 21 communities connected to CV Fiber. So everyone in the CV Fiber area is probably hoping to have your service as soon as possible. So how do you determine what areas you'll provide service to first? How do you prioritize?
We've been prioritizing based on the greatest need of the greatest number of underserved or unserved residents. And we've decided to go at this very quickly and fast, go as fast and far as possible. We're looking to hire multiple construction crews and to build year-round. And as you know, as a Vermonter, that is challenging because of mud season and winter, but we want to do as much as we can. So we're looking to build the first few distribution areas in parts of Calais, Woodbury, East Montpelier, and Worcester that have the most passings or addresses that are underserved or unserved at the moment. And then we'll work downward from there, from north to south, going east downward and west downward. We are going to prioritize the most people who are underserved first. That's the goal.
Appropriately, you're looking to build at high speed. So what does the...
that is right.
Took you a moment right there. what does the full timeline look like to reach all of the interested customers in your service area?
It will be about 4 years, most likely. Now that's just for the underserved and unserved. We do expect to reach some of the more populated and already served areas, say of Montpelier and certain portions of East Montpelier that are already serviced after we build out the network for the underserved and unserved. So that will take beyond the 4 years to get to every single address. But for the unserved or underserved who simply don't have the option at this moment in time, it will take about 4 years to build everything out at the current projection.
And do you have any idea how many homes, how many businesses that first phase, that underserved number is that you'll get to in the first 4 years?
It might be in the range of 5,000 addresses.
Wow.
But that doesn't swap out business versus residential.
Sure.
Most of our addresses are considered residential, even though we do have some businesses in our jurisdiction.
Yeah, 5,000, that's a big number to tackle. You currently have 21 cities and towns taking part. Can others that are interested still become a part of CV Fiber?
So any town can become a member of the CUD or any town, even if it's not connected in physically contiguous to the CV Fiber territory, any town can become a member district. You need a physical hookup in order to connect to the fiber. So you would need to be within a member district town in order to receive CV Fiber's high-speed internet.
Gotcha. We've talked about the reasons this technology is needed throughout the state, but what kind of impact will connecting these communities have economically, socially, and for future development?
Well, everything. If you can connect to your colleagues in San Francisco, California, and do a Zoom call developing a new technology that solves a medical problem, then you can work on solutions of any kind in any industry with any technology from the comfort of your living room or business located within the woods of rural Vermont. You will be able to utilize applications that rely on high-speed internet. I touched on it before, but farming applications that will allow farmers to be more productive will be a resource that is available to the industries that are important to Vermont and Vermonters. Technology for education, going to school, getting a degree, even if you don't have access to the physical school, will be achievable by students of all ages in Vermont. And smart technologies that might hook up to applications that require high-speed internet, that will allow you to check your own health, that will allow you to visit your doctor, that will allow you to, from the road, see inside your refrigerator if you need another gallon of milk or something along those lines. It goes down to everything that we do is now reliant on connectivity. And Vermont is as important as any other place at receiving and being part of this high-speed connectivity.
Janelle Smith is the executive director of CV Fiber. To learn more, you can visit cvfiber.net. Janelle, thanks so much for being on the show this morning.
Thank you, Rick, for having me. Have a wonderful day.
You too. We're going to break for news and then be back to check in with national correspondent Bob Ney. And don't forget, still looking for a potential guest at 10:30 if you'd like to be interviewed. You can email me, vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Give us a phone number. Let us know what we can chat about. And today at 1 o'clock, it's mucho, mucho Greg Hooker in the full-blown 3-hour version of La Escapada, or as we call it here, The Getaway. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
We hope you're enjoying this podcast of Vermont Viewpoint with Rick Singeri. You can find podcasts of some of the other programs on our website. In addition, we also have CBS podcasts, including Sunday Morning with Jane Pauley and 60 Minutes. For a full listing of podcasts, visit our website at wdevradio.com.
We're back on Vermont Viewpoint. I'll be taking tomorrow and Monday off. So we moved our cleanup hitter one day up in the lineup. Joining me now to give us his insight into what's happening around the country and the world is national correspondent Bob Ney. Bob, thanks for joining us this morning.
Well, thank you, Rick.
You're welcome. All right, let's start with Nancy Pelosi's trip. How did China react to the House Speaker's trip to Taiwan?
Well, Rick, they certainly aren't happy, and that's putting it mildly.
Yeah.
There's two things you can do that I saw in my 11 years in the House that you can do to China to completely freak them out. One is to support Taiwan, visit there, you know, especially somebody of the Speaker's stature, which Newt Gingrich went there in, I think, 96. But the other thing is to recognize the Dalai Lama. They go crazy over that, too, when he visits the United States. So those are the two things. Obviously, Speaker Pelosi went to Taiwan. The Chinese started to fire some missiles into the ocean. They did drills. They're cutting off some, not all, but some of the exports from Taiwan to China, soybeans, et cetera. Now, I think that might be, you know, temporary. So they weren't, again, very happy about it. And the speaker moved from Taiwan to South Korea to visit, and then I think the trip ends there.
Yeah, how did the Taiwanese people react to her visit there?
Well, Taiwan's is a mixed bag. There's two big political parties, and the Kuomintang is one of them, and it recognizes the Chinese principle of, you know, two places, one nation. You know, in other words, Taiwan is under China. And then the second political party, I think it's called the Democratic Party of Taiwan, does not recognize China having the rule over Taiwan. So the reaction will be mixed. But obviously, members of the government were happy that she came, and maybe some mixed reaction in the population. It's all a little bit varied, just like Hong Kong used to be.
Yeah.
Whenever you would visit there, there'd be a mixed reaction.
Gotcha. All right, let's turn to gasoline. OPEC is upping its output. Why are they doing this? What effect might this have?
Well, a tiny, tiny bit. It's actually going to be 100,000 barrels in the scope of the worldwide distribution of OPEC oil. And President Biden had visited Saudi Arabia, and, of course, Mohammed bin Salman, MBS, the ruler of the kingdom, is very powerful in the OPEC world. But they have agreed to, you know, up it a bit. Now, there's a theory that there's going to be a larger increase, which will help President Biden, because right now he's taking a lot of heat for going over to the kingdom and getting this in return, which, frankly, 100,000 barrels, like I said, in a day worldwide will do very, very minuscule amounts to help with our gas prices.
It sounds like a lot, but it just, I guess it points to the fact of how much we use. We're kind of dependent on oil for our existence. Pretty crazy.
Sure are.
Yeah. All right, let's talk NATO. Finland, Sweden, they had the vote in the Senate. What happened?
Yes, the Senate voted to support, which is part of the process, to support NATO's entry by Sweden and Finland into NATO. The entire NATO organization has to, you know, approve it. So obviously, the United States saying yes is a good thing, and it's a big deal. And it voted 95-1. I am not sure who the one member was. I would guess Rand Paul.
Oh, yeah, that would make sense.
I would guess. I served with his father, Ron Paul. If you ever made me guess, then it'd be the one vote. It would be Ron Paul, maybe Rand Paul. But after this, the process goes through NATO. Now, there was a bit in the beginning of a controversy. Turkey was saying they may not do it, but they've come around now. So it looks like both countries will go into NATO, which is interesting because they had, frankly, Rick, no intention, as you know, to be part of NATO until Russia did what it did with the Ukraine.
You know, I'm wondering, Bob, why are we so more bothered by the invasion of Ukraine by Russia than, I don't know how many years ago, five, seven years ago, when it invaded Georgia?
You know, that's a good question. I think that probably the – I'm going to just guess here. Part of it is the fact that the Ukraine has developed as a separate sovereign nation, which is what it is, no matter what Russia says, has developed a lot of structure of advocacy. I know Andy Foote from Ohio, for example, who used to work for Governor Voinovich, the late Senator Voinovich after that. Andy Foote was head of the Ukrainian American coalition here, and they had a lot of people that were very well known, very politically connected, you know, people. And so I think that Ukraine just probably more than Georgia outreached and established itself. I mean, if you look back at the history, for example, of when China went after Tibet, Tibet had closed itself off from the world. Then it appealed to, I think, President Eisenhower at the time to help it out, but it was quite too late. It was always isolated. So I think that Ukraine probably, one of the factors is that it was more outreaching than Georgia was.
Good point. All right. The veteran bill last week was voted down, this week passed. First of all, how will this benefit our veterans?
Well, it'll benefit the veterans because the whole burn pit issue, and this goes back to like Agent Orange. I was on the Veterans Committee with Bernie Sanders back in 1995, and we were going through the Agent Orange situation, and there was basically a cutoff time. And the committee agreed in a bipartisan basis to extend that because, you know, you don't know the future ramifications of what happens to people with toxic material. And the burn pits are, you know, are in that direction too. You know, what's the effect? What's the long-lasting effect? Plus the monetary assistance for health care, you know, et cetera. So I think the bill is a great, it's a life-saving measure really for health care benefits for Iraq and Afghani war veterans who were exposed to these toxic burn pits.
What was the problem that there were no voters last week? And was, you know, whatever that situation was it rectified in the vote taken this week?
Well, let me defend their procedural vote, and
absolutely.
Then let me say I would never have voted as they did.
Okay.
If that makes
fair
sense.
Enough. Yep.
It's a procedural vote because what happened was there was $400 billion and it was marked whether it was going to be discretionary money or mandatory spending, which has future ramifications. And it ended up that it was in the category of mandatory that the some of the Republicans didn't like as a matter of budgetary principle. Now, I would say if we were back to 1998 with the first balanced budget in generations, they could better argue that point than what's been going on in Congress the last 14 years of overspending the budgets.
Right.
The Congress and the presidents, you know, have done that. So, again, they had a procedural vote. The reason I said I wouldn't have voted for it, you can't explain that vote. Then there were a series of amendments which went down, but they got their chance to vote on it to show they're, quote, fiscally responsible. So, like I said, this is one of those bills that you really have to think, how do I defend, you know, what I'm voting for as a procedural mechanical vote on an issue of spending. And again, the budgets have been so blown over anyway over the years. This was a weird bill to pick a time to stand up fiscally and say, let's clarify this.
Point well taken. And the Secret Service emails, first of all, what are these emails that are missing?
Wow. This one, Rick, I am so confused, and I've read just about every story humanly possible, and I've watched what they do back and forth to the committee. The new twist is coming because there is a, you know, the original issue, were they deleted, weren't they deleted? They were deleted because of a programming switchover of, you know, the electronics from, I guess, texts were lost through that switchover. Well, now, all of a sudden, after this is being debated and they're trying to find the emails and they're reporting to the January 6th committee, the Homeland Security Inspector General that oversees the probe into this was previously accused of misleading investigators back in 2013. That was released yesterday. Mm-hmm. So the very person, Joseph Kufari, who was supposed to be, you know, overseeing this entire situation, is being accused of a cover-up in his office in 2013. So that adds another level of, wow, is he factual? Is he not? Is he telling the truth? Is he not? So I would say we have to stay tuned to see, are they or aren't they? Will they be produced or won't they? Are they on the iCloud somewhere? We don't know yet.
Mm. All right. Well, I know I'm going to, if I need to hide emails ever, I'm going to have a technical switchover and get Kufari in to help me out so I can outrun my past. National correspondent Bob Ney, I appreciate your flexibility and, of course, your perspective. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
All right. Let's take a break, and then we're going to hear from Sally Pollock of 7 Days about the Von Trapp Gardens in Waitsfield. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. It's time to get out in nature for a few minutes and peruse the lovely natural gardens of Toby and Sally Von Trapp in Waitsfield. Serving as our guide is someone who recently wrote about them in 7 Days, Sally Pollack. Sally, welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint.
Hi, Rick.
Hi. Who are Sally and Toby Von Trapp?
So Sally and Toby Von Trapp are a couple, a married couple in their late 60s who live in Waitsfield on the Common Road, which is a beautiful, beautiful sort of high dirt road that runs parallel to Vermont 100 and has wonderful views looking west to Mount Ellen and sort of the Sugar Bush Mountain Range. And Toby grew up on a dairy farm in Waitsfield, and Sally is from the Philadelphia area.
That is a great way to describe that ride out to their place on the Common Road. You know, it really is one of my favorite drives here in Vermont. And are they any connection or relation to the singing Von Trapps?
They are, yeah. It's a gorgeous place. It's stunning, even by Vermont standards. Yes, Toby, whose formal name is Tobias, is the grandson of Captain Von Trapp, who was sort of the father of the family, not sort of, was the father of the families that was made known in The Sound of Music. Toby's father, Werner Von Trapp, was one of the musical family members and singers who was one of the people who escaped. He was a young adult when his family escaped Nazi-occupied Austria, and that family settled in Stowe.
I'm glad you corrected yourself. It's not sort of the father. That would have been, that would have been quite an expose that you would have had to do as a follow-up in next week's 7 Days. Let's start with the Von Trapp greenhouse. Give us a little history of this place that so many in the Mad River Valley and central Vermont had come to know.
So the Von Trapp greenhouse was a business started by Sally and Toby 41 years ago in 1980, and it was at their home in Waitsfield where they raised 3 children. And it sort of evolved over the years. It started with Toby growing vegetables and selling them long before anyone had used the phrase farm to table. He had a vegetable garden, big vegetable garden, and he sold to local restaurants. And they started growing flowers and annuals, and then sort of the business evolved into several greenhouses where they raised and grew annuals and perennials and sold them to people. And that business closed Labor Day weekend of 2021.
That's the greenhouse. Give us an overview of the gardens.
The gardens were connected to the greenhouse or on the same land. And in 1992, and they became a part of people's visits to the greenhouse, was going to the gardens, which are absolutely stunning, just simply beautiful. And you talked earlier about getting out in nature. This is designed and planted and planned garden, but it has a very natural feel, unmanicured. And it's Toby started in 1992, and the first thing he did, he spent 4 years preparing the soil. It was an old hay field, and he for 4 years planted it in cover crops, including sunflowers, buckwheat, winter rye, pulled stones from it, and tilled the land. And after 4 years, he then designed and started planting the garden in the mid-90s. And it's got a mix of perennials, it's got bushes, fern, little ground cover. And at the western edge is a thing I fell particularly in love with is a fountain he built from stones, from old stone walls, and also just rocks he pulled out of the hayfield.
You mentioned, Sally, that when the garden center was open, that the gardens were open to people. You know, it was kind of an attraction when you came to the greenhouse. You could go back and wander through the gardens. Are they open now to the public?
So this summer, including this coming weekend, Friday and Saturday, tomorrow and the next day, and then two dates in the future, including Labor Day weekend, they will be open to the public for a $10 donation as a fundraiser for the Mad River Valley Rotary. The Von Trapps, you know, it was an annual visit for many people. It was an attraction in the Mad River Valley. And the Von Trapps wanted to, as Sally said, we wanted to thank people for supporting us for the past four decades and just welcome visitors back. So people can come, and Sally and Toby will be there sort of taking people on tours of the garden. And so that's this Friday and Saturday is the next one. And one of the fun things that I found as a non-gardener, and I think gardeners would find it super interesting, is their technique, their method for gardening. And both Sally and Toby are, in her words, terrible stuffers. By terrible, she means very much not bad. And they like to just fill space with plants. She said, we can never have too much plants. And so it's both their aesthetic and their kind of gardening method. And by filling and by having plants pretty much everywhere, but in a certain order, that an aesthetic that is just fabulous, it precludes the growth of weeds. Okay, there's no space or light for weeds, and Toby also doesn't mulch. So it's also been a sort of an experiment in sustainable and efficient gardening. And I was fascinated to learn of his cleanup process at the end of the season. He takes a weed whacker and he goes right into this garden, which you look at and you're like, no, don't put a weed whacker in there. You know, you don't want to touch it. But of course, I don't know anything about gardening. And he cuts the herbaceous plants down to about a foot and a half. And then it's like genius. He takes a lawnmower and pulls it backward, okay, and blows all the plant debris back into the garden where it's a nutrient for the soil. It mulches the ground, and it distributes seeds for self-starts. And I was like, did you invent that? And I'm sure he did. He said, oh, I just kind of stumbled upon it, you know. And anyway, once you hear it, you're like, wow, everyone should do that.
Yeah. So, well, speaking of aesthetic, you know, one thing we don't do often enough is to give a tip of the cap to the photography that accompanies the stories. And in this one in particular, the photography is absolutely stunning.
Jeb Wallace Broder. I know. The whole thing should just be photos because it's such a visual place, and that's how you can see the story. And if anyone looks at the photos in 7 days this week, they will be at the Von Trapp Garden on Friday and Saturday. Yeah. I plan to go back for one of these weekends because, you know, you could spend all day there. And there's a pergola he built. So the eastern side, the western edge is this fountain. That moss has come to, he didn't plant the moss, it just appeared there, as do frogs. He said, I don't know how they sense this, there's water. They either hear it or they feel it. And these frogs have made a home in his fountain, which it shows very good sense for frogs, because it's a place anyone would want to be. And then the eastern edge is a pergola, so you can find shade there. And then, as Toby said, it's like a managed wildflower garden, and that's a wildflower meadow. And that really is the feel. That's really what it seems like.
So it's this Friday and Saturday. The cost is $10. Do you know the times it'll be open?
9 to 3.
And do you need a reservation, or can you just show up?
No, you can just show up. You can get tickets in advance, but you can just show up. And if you just show up, you should bring cash, is what I hear. But it's this Friday and Saturday, and then it's also August 19th and 20th and September 2nd and 3rd. And it's a fundraiser for the Mad River Valley Rotary, which will then distribute it to local nonprofits. And I think the first one, there's been one weekend already, raised about $2,000. Oh, so it's nice. Both, you know, a beautiful, beautiful place to be in a lovely just afternoon, and you know, it'll help area nonprofits.
What's happening now with the greenhouses at the Garden Center?
Emily von Trapp, one of their daughters, is she's a wonderful story in her own right, is a tulip farmer and more cut flower specialist, but her particular focus is season extended cut flowers. So she grows tulips all winter. Okay. And she's also doing work with cut flowers, other flowers, through lilies in particular, through many months of the year. And she's doing, she does workshops to help people learn about this. And so she's sort of expanding her business and using her family's greenhouses for that. And her business is called Von Trapp Flowers.
We got about 30 seconds left, Sal. And then is there some connection to the Von Trapp Farmstead that's just down the road?
That is, well, it's, they would be Sebastian Von Trapp is Emily's cousin and Toby and Sally's nephew.
Gotcha.
And I guess, and his brother and his brother's wife also worked there. So they're all part of the Von Trapp family. Yeah. And that's a dairy farm and a cheese making operation. They make cheese.
And great there. Meats.
Yeah.
You can read Sally Pollock's story in this week's issue of 7 Days or at 7daysvt.com. Sally, great having you on again. Thanks so much.
Thanks a lot. Okay, bye. Thanks.
Bye. We're going to take a CBS News break, and then we'll open up the phones or maybe have a surprise listener guest. We haven't had anybody bite, but if you'd like to be interviewed, you want to be on the radio, you can email me now, vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com, and we'll see what happens. Or not. Coming up today at 11, we've got Common Sense Radio with Bill Sayre. It's followed by the Midday News Service with Lee Cattell and Brady Farkas. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
In decades past, you opened a business, hung out your shingle, and the customers came. Today, hanging out your shingle means creating an engaging website. The modern consumer is using the internet to find businesses like yours. Are you positioned so you'll rise to the top of their search? Let the Radio Vermont Group Digital Services work with you to make sure you're visible online and to target your marketing to location, demographic, and interest. Learn more at rvgdigital.com.
Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. All right. Here's what's happening. I offered to give airtime to any listener who was interested in being interviewed. We did have one bite. Wild Bill says, yeah, I'm on board, but he can't do it today. But you know me, if you even walk past the front of the building slowly, you could be a guest on this show. So Wild Bill, we'll get him on. We'll figure out a time to have Wild Bill on. So for now, it's open phones at 802-244-1777, 877-291-8255. I'm going to be sneaking out on you for a few days. It will be back on Tuesday. So you'll have Brad Freeland as your host tomorrow, and then Steve Pappas of the Times Argus and Rutland Herald on Monday. So please treat them kindly. But as for now, we've got the phones open. I'll be heading, first to the Dorset Theater Festival to see Back Together Again. This is about Roberta Flack and Donny Hathaway. And then I'll also see one of my Scottish bands called Churches. They're playing at Mass Mocha. So I'm heading down to that part of the world. And then I'm going to stop at the Clark in the Clark Museum in Williamstown. There is a Rodin exhibit going on there, and I'm going to go see it, and then we'll have someone on to talk about it on Tuesday when I get back. We'll hear about that. So if you've got suggestions for me on what to see, where to stop, where to eat in southern Vermont or the Berkshires, please share them. I'm hoping to get to Ernie's Hand-Carved in Rutland. I also want to get to the Rablogan Castle of Scotland. That's where the Scottish store is down in Arlington that has things like haggis and haggis sausage. Oh, and I'll also be playing – this is going to be something because I haven't done it in a number of years. I'm going to be playing a round of golf at Mountain View Country Club in Greensboro on Monday. Oh, my. Any golf pros with tips – call me. You can call right now and tell me what to do, how to take a few hundred strokes off my game. 802-244-1777, 877-291-8255. You can email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. And we've got phones open till 11. This is my getaway day. So, you know, feel free. Jump on the line and we'll talk about, you know, open phones too. We can also talk about whatever open subject you want to talk about. All right. We're heading to Warren, lovely Warren, and we're going to talk to Dan. Hi, Dan. What's going on? Or Dave. I'm sorry, Dave.
Say hello.
Hey, Dave. You're up.
Okay, great. So I just wanted can I talk a little bit about the climate refugees that are coming to Vermont?
Sure.
And what kind of implications they have for our local traffic problems in downtowns and so on.
Yeah.
And let's just take a look at Waterbury, for example. After the big flood, there's a lot of ideas. What should you do? Because Waterbury claims to be the recreation crossroads of Vermont.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what it was when there was the train. But the trolley is missing. They took the trolley out from Waterbury to Stowe.
That's right.
And you try to drive from Waterbury to Stowe now on Route 100. It is like, I was there. I counted 300 cars in one big pile.
Yeah.
So what I'm suggesting is that there's a missing kind of entity or power. Because the town elected officials come up with the zoning law and says you can have one house per acre or something like that. Then the developers come along and say, okay, I'll look at that and because I'm trying to make money at it.
Mm-hmm.
And so they look and they say, well, I don't want to build cheap houses because there's so many people want an expensive one. I'll do that. So nobody's going to build anything affordable.
Yeah.
So everyone's going to have to drive somewhere else. What's missing is an overview that has power. And here's an example of what happened at the in Williston, Taft Four Corners. When the Pyramid Mall was proposed, which was a giant building surrounded by cars, the group in Williston called the CRG, Citizens for Responsible Growth, protested, said this is not a good idea. So they went to court and they held it up. Finally, the judge said, "Okay, you got to come up with something you will approve." So the CRG actually said, "Wait a minute, why don't we come up with what we think is a good idea?" And so they came up with what is now called Maple Tree Place, a big town green with shops and stores around it, and,
mm-hmm.
and a typical Vermont idea. And that happened because a community group said, this is what we think should happen. Now, let's take a look at Waterbury. What makes Waterbury interesting? It could be, here's a proposal that was suggested, was that you could have, because you drive down the interstate, all you see is the big smokestack for the hospital.
Mm-hmm.
But let's suppose that Waterbury became a jump center. We have these towers where people are trying to learn how to ski jump.
Mm-hmm.
You know, something's happening there in the back. You know, if the trolley was put back in gear, so you could go from Waterbury to Stowe, and really ideally, they might as well take one from Waterbury to the Mad River Valley as well.
Yeah,
these ideas don't happen because of the select board. They don't happen because of developers. There's some other entity. And you know, historically, you know, like Central Park in New York, or the Golden Gate Park, or the Lincoln Park in Chicago, all these things happened because some other entity said, "Yeah, let's just do this."
Yeah.
So I'm worried that in the future of Vermont, there it's just going to be a pile and pile and pile of small scale development, money making guys coming because I don't blame them.
Yeah.
Doing something that doesn't really fit any larger vision.
I should mention this is Dave Sellers, who certainly knows of what he speaks. And Dave, you know,
These points are so well taken. The fact that our biggest problem in this state is the lack of what you're talking about, mass transportation, and we're all getting in, you know, individual cars and driving. And, you know, I know right now, you know, I made some of these trips you're talking about just recently. Tuesday night I went out and restaurants were jam packed. We, you know, this is our tourist economy, which we love so much, but it certainly does, you know, clog these roads. And we don't have any other way to get people around, but for them to get, you know, in their automobiles, and drive from point A to point B. Dave, these are great points. I need to have you back on for us to discuss this in real detail, if you don't mind. I'd love to invite you back on to talk about this.
That's great. I'm all for it.
I love it. Thanks, Dave. Thanks for calling.
Bye-bye.
All right. We're going to take a break. I've got a couple more callers that we'll get to here on Open Phones. We've got them open till 11. If you want to hop in, 802-244-1777, 877-291-TALK. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. I'm Rick Sengary. Hey, hey, the phones are open. Your last chance to harangue me until Tuesday. We had Kevin and Kevin, the wine guys, on yesterday. Any wine recommendations for you? I'll be headed to Southern Vermont, Western Mass. Any suggestions where I should go? And I'll be playing a round of golf on Monday. Any tips to shave those strokes off my game? 802-244-1777, 877-291-8255. All right, let's head to Cabot and talk to Michael. I'm guessing, Michael, this is the owner of the Scale House Restaurant. Are you open?
I am not the owner. I'm just the operator, general manager.
That's right. Sorry.
But no, we are not open, and there's no real solid timeline on that currently.
All right.
I'm not sure where the breakdown really is, and, you know, between the state owns the building and it's operated by a property management group and an insurance. So it's all still a big mess. So
all right.
I was actually calling to check in with you on, you're going to Western Massachusetts. You mentioned Williamstown. So
yes,
when I get down in that direction on the Route 7 corridor, I like to go to, I make it maybe a little bit further south, to Great Barrington or Hancock.
Right.
And Great Barrington has one of the best Greek salad dressings you'll ever run into at Four Brothers Pizza.
Ah.
And that's right on, I'm pretty sure it's right on Route 7. And then in Hancock, the cool thing about Hancock is that they do and I'm not sure they're still doing it. I worked down there years ago, but there's a Shaker Village there, and they do a rare breeds festival.
Hmm.
And when I went down there, I'd found an ad in the Country Folks magazine. I was like 20 years old, and there was a farm offer in Housen to come and work on this farm. And the thing about Lineback cattle, as we know them today, is that they were part of a closed herd in southern Vermont. I can't remember the name of the town where they started, but the Randall breed is what the now Lineback cattle comes from.
Yep, our state
breed. And the story I heard from the guy that operated the farm that I worked on was that the guy wouldn't even sell one of his bulls or cows to his brother-in-law because he was so tight about keeping his herd the way he wanted his herd to be.
Wow.
And he wouldn't even budge on it. So, and when I went to the Rare Breeds Festival there at the Hancock Shaker Village, they still have a round barn there and all the old buildings that have the old cook ovens, the Dutch ovens, I guess you might call them, the mm-hmm. brick ovens that were built into the basements of houses and the first floor of houses. And so that was a pretty interesting thing. I think they still maintain a seed bank there.
Oh, this is all so great stuff.
And then Kent, Connecticut, if you haven't been to Kent, that's a beautiful little town. The Appalachian Trail passes through there, and they've got some pretty eccentric art going on in that town.
All right. This is great stuff, Michael. I thank you for that. I will mention that I will head to Greenfield. There's a great Treehouse Brewery that I'll stop into as well. And Michael, what you're saying just makes me realize I need to go down for a number of days to the Berkshires and to really spend time there. All right. Thanks, Michael. Let's get one more call in. Oh, it is the Duke of Newbury. Your Grace?
You got it. Yeah, this is nobody's talking about this. It is long-term health care. And the problem is Vermont and Maine are the oldest states, and it costs about $10,000 a month for a nursing home. That's the average cost. And nobody can afford it. And so it looks like the state of Vermont is probably going to go into real estate business. That's what I'm guessing.
Mm.
I don't know how else they're going to pay for it.
Well, the other thing, Fred, that we've seen, I think it was even before the pandemic, but pandemic certainly exacerbated the situation. But, you know, we're losing a lot of those beds. It's difficult to operate.
That's right.
And then with, you know, losing so many workers from the workforce, you know, these aren't great paying jobs. They're not particularly, I don't know how to say it, but they're not, the jobs that people are rushing to fill, let's say. And so, that's the other thing. The staffing situation, at these, nursing homes, are getting tighter and tighter. So, you are pointing to a situation, that has been, kind of below the surface for the last few years and has been a bit of a problem, but is starting to bubble up even more and more. And as you say, Fred, with the aging population that we have in Vermont, this will probably become more of a situation that's going to need to be addressed, and it's probably going to be quite costly.
I agree. Yeah, it's going to be a mess because nobody can afford it. And, you know, if you got a house and it's worth $200,000 or $300,000, the state's going to get it.
Yeah.
And you might get not very much left.
Yeah.
You know? Or yeah. Your heirs might not get anything left.
Yeah, good
so
point.
It's a bleak situation.
Yeah. Anything you can do for my drives or my iron game, you know, when I head out to the golf course, Fred?
You know, that was, you know, golfing was my dream. I had a dream that I could beat Nicholas on the fairways of my imagination. you know what you ought to do? If you're not a very good driver, maybe you could concentrate on your short game. If you play the short game, you could win.
Yeah, my game, I'll tell you what the strength of my game is. It's the shortest game, and that is putting. But getting to the green, and it's true, I'm a killer putter, Fred.
What you got to do now, you don't have to worry about putting. Get your 9-iron or your sand wedge, and you practice with that.
Yeah, just hit nice little lobs all the way up the fairway. Get it onto the green in six, and then two putt for a snowman. Take an eight on every
hole.
Yeah, right.
That's exactly right. You're say 25 yards away from the hole, or 30 yards away from the hole. You take your sand wedge, and you pop it right up there, and you get within 10 inches of the pin, and then you nail it.
Yeah.
You're a winner.
All right. The Fred School of Golf. Thank you. Thank you, Your Grace, for that. All right. That is the Duke of Newbury. And that's probably a new low on Vermont Viewpoint, where I'm taking golf tips from the Duke without portfolio. I love that. I am golfing on Monday at Mountain View Country Club, and I have been assured, first of all, that it is a slow day on the links there, so there shouldn't be too many foursomes that I'm harassing with my errant shots or slowing the pace of play down. But the other thing is the people I'm playing with, I'm told, are lenient and don't take the game too very seriously. And so we can only hope that that is the case. I can't even remember the last time I got out. I think it was down in Orlando, played in a tournament, and it was a best ball tournament. And that way, it didn't matter how terrible my shots were. You always took the best shot of the foursome. And I think we used maybe one of my chips onto the green at one point, and we used a number of my putts. If I could play like that all the time, I'd be on the tour, man. Or maybe I should just stick to the putt-putt, to just go out and play on those. We'll see. Maybe Tuesday or next week, when we have open phones, I will let you know what exactly transpired out on the links. I will tell you that next Friday, too, I will be broadcasting live from that great antique car show and meet here in Waterbury. That's the 12th, so that goes on the 12th, 13th, and 14th that weekend. And that morning, the 12th, I believe, is the Friday, I will be broadcasting live from Farr's Field doing that. All right. Yes, sir, Danny. That will do it for me until Tuesday. Shut it down. All right. That's our show for today. Vermont Viewpoint is directed by Danny McGivrigan. Feel free to suggest topics, guests, or yourself as a guest. You can email me, vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. You can listen to past episodes of Vermont Viewpoint by downloading our podcast at wdevradio.com, or you can also subscribe to the podcast. Common Sense Radio with Bill Sarah's up next. I'm Rick Singeri. I'll meet you back here on Tuesday.